Open your Bibles to Nehemiah chapter 6 again this morning. We're going to finish up the sixth chapter of Nehemiah, get into the first few verses of Nehemiah chapter 7. I told you during the announcement time that I was going to explain a little bit about this wristband and keeping it on. I'm a very faithful Unity Festival guy, but when we had the opportunity to go down and experience Big Ticket Festival in Ionia this year instead of way up in Gaylord, we thought, well, let's go and see what it's like. I'd never been to the Ionia Fairgrounds before and never been to Big Ticket Festival, and they had a really great lineup on Friday. And every time I go to something that provides a wristband, I find myself wanting to keep the wristband on if there was something spiritually significant that happened. And if you would have known me back in the days that the Promise Keeper movement, for example, was really big. I went to Promise Keepers in Pontiac, and I pretty much kept that wristband on until it rotted off. I mean, a real long time. And it got to a point at the end of that where I sort of felt like Moses. You know, Moses came down from the mountain having met with God and received the Ten Commandments, and his face glowed, and so he covered his face so that the people wouldn't be afraid and freaked out and distracted by the fact that being with God had caused his face to glow. But the Bible says that after a while, he actually kept that veil on so that the people wouldn't realize that the glow had gone. And I felt that way with that wristband from Promise Keepers. I came back and was very much challenged and very much changed. And after a while, I would look at that, and I kept it on so that every time I would look at it, I would remember what it was that God had specifically challenged me with. And after a while, it became sort of an annoyance because I would look at that wristband and say, wow, you blew that one. You're not following through on that anymore. And so the commitments that we make in our lives can be significant. I don't know if any of you know who that is. It's a man named Nick Vojovic. And Nick is from Australia. He's a pastor's kid. And in case you're wondering if he was scuba diving at the Great Barrier Reef and two sharks bit each of his arms off, that is actually all of Nick that he was born with. Nick was born with only a torso, no arms and no legs. And on his left-hand side, he has one partial foot. And I've seen, I don't know who it was that shared with me some time back, a videotape on YouTube of Nick and sort of his life. And at that point in time, it was just some of the amazing things that Nick is able to do as a person who is without limbs. He swims, he golfs, he climbs stairs, he can cook his own meals, etc. It's remarkable. This is a picture I found. That's the girl from Hawaii who had a shark take off her left arm that the movie Soul Surfer was made about, Bethany. And that's them actually surfing together. And so Nick is this amazing guy. Friday night, before Toby Mac took main stage, program was running late. There had been some technical issues. And so everything was slowed down and backed up, and Marvin Sapp, pastor and gospel singer from Grand Rapids, was not going to get off the stage a second sooner than he had to. And so everything was sort of backed up. And I had really wanted to see and hear Nick. But I really wanted to see Toby Mac. And so when I looked at my cell phone, I'm going to say my watch, I don't wear a watch. When I looked at my cell phone and saw what time it was, I thought, I hope he's short. I hope he's to the point. I want to hear him speak, but... And Nick got up, and he started to talk about his life. He started to talk about what God had done in his life. This probably won't surprise you too much. But Nick went through many years of his life where he was very angry and very bitter and disappointed with God because he was born without limbs. He would never be able to walk in a normal way. He would never be able to hold the hand of a girlfriend, would never be able to hug his wife, would never be able to hold a child, on and on. And it's one thing if we as Christians take and put some big, burly, all-star athlete up here and say, here, stand behind this microphone and tell people that you love Jesus and why you love Jesus. And he gets up there and he says, hey, I've had a good life, you know, I'm a professional athlete, make millions of dollars, and I love Jesus. And the church goes, oh, yeah, yeah, that's kind of cool, you know, that you can be everything and still love Jesus too. That's really cool. Let me tell you something. You watch and you listen to Nick Vujovic and you think, how on earth can someone with that much in their life that's going against them love and trust and want to honor Jesus Christ in their life more than anything else? I made the mistake on the way home as Pam and I were talking about this, and I was trying to figure out why was what he said so impactful, not only to me, but to so many other people. And I said, you know, I think what it is because of all that he's gone through, because of all the things that he struggles with still every day, there's something about him that's just disarming. And Pam said, did you mean to say that? I said, I did not. I did not mean to say that. But there is something you cannot argue with the fact that he trusts God with his life, his today, and his future, just because he's found God worthy of that trust. And when he gave the invitation, after he shared his testimony and shared the gospel, I honestly did not know what to expect. And he said, if you want to receive Christ tonight, pray this prayer. And he prayed the prayer. And he said, if you prayed that prayer, I want you to be bold enough to raise your hand and let me know that you prayed that prayer. And I'm, of course, at that point in time, everyone's eyes open. I'm looking, and I can see hundreds. I see hundreds of hands go up. And Nick says, now hold on. I don't know if you understand what I said. I said, if you want to commit your life to be a follower of Jesus Christ, commit your life to him for the rest of your life, no turning back, complete surrender. That's what I meant. If you prayed the prayer for that reason, raise your hand. Same hundreds of hands went up. He said, I still don't know if you get me. I heard that there is a cross that's been erected here on the fairgrounds. Do you know where that cross is? And the crowd goes, yeah. He said, if you really mean that prayer, if you prayed that and you meant it and you want to follow Jesus Christ for the rest of your life, I want you to get up right now wherever you are and I want you to go to that cross. And hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people streamed past us from the front all the way back to the cross. And an hour into the Toby Mac concert, I still saw hundreds of people at the cross identifying with and doing business with God. Now, what does the future hold for those people? I don't know, but in that brief challenge, it reminded me of what I put on your outline as some of the most basic spiritual lessons that everyone needs to think about, they need to wrestle through. You need to say, on which side of the fence, as Jim sang about, on which side of the fence am I? Or am I trying to straddle the fence? Am I trying to stay right on top of the fence so I'm not clearly on one side or the other? These are what I think are some of the most basic spiritual lessons. First, you have to ask yourself this question. Am I resisting God in my life? Are there parts of God and parts of what he offers? I mean, do I want salvation and go to heaven instead of hell? Well, duh. But does that mean that I want him to have all of me today? Do I want to make my choices and decisions today based on my relationship with him? If there is any way in my life that I'm resisting my God, I need to surrender that. And the initial step of having a relationship with God by faith is to say, listen, I can't resist you. I have to surrender to you and surrender to your will. Next, if you look at your life and go, hey, I think I'm good enough. I think I've gone far enough. I think I've matured enough. I think I'm spiritual enough. You're not. If you think you're good enough, you're not. You need to humble yourself. This submission and this honoring of God and giving him the priority needs to be something that happens day after day after day. In fact, moment by moment. If you've fallen, if you made a commitment, if you wore the wristband, if you identified and then stopped identifying, if you've fallen, get up. Get up. The enemy of our soul, that is the number one lie that he tells people. You've fallen, that means you were a phony. Stay down there. You're not worthy of getting back up again. If you've fallen, get up. And here's the last one. If you've committed something, follow through. When I went to Promise Keepers, there were things that I committed that I stopped following through on. That's why that wristband became such an odious reminder to me at times of how I'd committed things and then took them back from my relationship with God. The fact is, if we have committed something to Him, and most of us can point to a specific time in our lives when Jesus really had our full attention and our complete devotion. That's the place that we need to strive to keep going back to. Men, you came back from Promise Keepers weekend a better husband and father. You need to keep going back there. Women, whatever conference or event or retreat you went to, you came back committed to being a different wife and a different mother, and you need to keep going back to that commitment and back to that place. And our young people, we send them away to retreats and to camps for a reason, because we know that in a unique way, God meets young people there, and we need to help them and encourage them to follow through on the commitments that we make. How can we keep the commitments that we make? I would direct your attention to the top of the outline if you have the back of your bulletin facing you. Look what it says, George Matheson. We conquer not in any brilliant fashion. We conquer by simply continuing. We continue. We continue to follow through on the commitments that we made. And that, in an interesting way, is the place where Nehemiah and the people in Jerusalem find themselves this morning. Their commitment has paid off. And it hasn't been decades, it hasn't even been years, it's been months, but it's been tough work, and their commitment that they've made to work and cooperate with Nehemiah and finish the wall has paid off, and they win. Well, we'll find out in a moment that victory to some didn't exactly look exactly like victory to other people, but they win. They've endured threats and opposition. They've dealt with mountains of rubble, some really difficult work, probably stones weighing hundreds and hundreds of pounds. They've worked in spite of food shortages. They've had serious relationship struggles with each other. And they've had a leader, Nehemiah, who, because of wisdom and vision and courage, has helped them stick together. And so here's what it says, chapter 6, verses 15 and 16. So the wall was completed on the 25th of Elul. In 52 days, when all our enemies heard about this, all the surrounding nations were afraid and lost their confidence because they realized, listen to this, because they realized that this work had been done with the help of our God. And so the people stick together in spite of all of that adversity, and the wall is completed. It is up 4.5 miles approximately of city wall surrounding Jerusalem, a minimum of 10 feet tall. That's a lot of work to get done in under 2 months' time, don't you think? And so not only the size of the project, but the speed in which it was completed points to God. It proves that their God was with them, that their God was in this. This is an evidence of His hand and His blessing on them. I mean, can you imagine? Here's this ragtag group of people who have never built a wall before. Just 9 months earlier, Nehemiah was in the court of King Artaxerxes and was hearing for the first time of the conditions in and around Jerusalem. He spent 4 months in prayer waiting for God's timing and God's open door. He arrives in Jerusalem to find a group of Jews that were fairly apathetic. They had pretty much gotten used to the idea of living in and around a city that offered them no protection, just humiliation. But a prayed-up, fired-up man shows up, and less than 2 months later, the wall is rebuilt. And the result is a reverence, a holy fear for their God. I mean, this wall getting completed in spite of all of the junk and obstacles that have been thrown at Nehemiah and the workers by their enemies, it makes those people step back and say, wow, what is going on with them? Who is this God that's for them? Sanballat, Tobiah, Geshem, and the rest had viewed this to an extent, I think, as sort of a high-stakes chess match. That it was between them and the Jews' strong leader, Nehemiah. And they thought they were just matching wits with a great motivator, but now they see the God behind the man. And when I see that, it makes me ask myself this question. When people see me with whatever gifts and abilities and so on that I might seem to have, do I want them to really see me, or do I want them to see the God who is behind all of that? If I want the attention, if I want the spotlight, if I want people to notice me, there's probably something wrong, because it's not supposed to be about me. And if I'm really, really honest, I know that this isn't anything good, anything worthy because of me. I want them to see the God that is behind this. I want me to be seen as an instrument, not as the conductor of this. So now, the wall's done. The enemies are going to give up, right? If you've looked and thought that there should be nothing after chapter 6 when the wall is completed, you go, why is there more book here? Why is there more? It's because of this. The enemy doesn't give up. The enemy simply changes tactics. In fact, what we're going to discover is that the enemy had been preparing other options the entire time. It goes back to the way the people, the Jews that were sent back from their captivity, the ones that were sent back from the exile first, the way that they behaved when they first got back impacts now. Decades later, what they did is going to impact Nehemiah and the security of the city. Chapter 6, verses 17 through 19. Also in those days, the nobles of Judah were sending many letters to Tobiah, and replies from Tobiah kept coming to them. For many in Judah were under oath to him, since he was son-in-law to Shechaniah, son of Ara, and the son of Jehoiachin was married to the daughter of Meshullam, son of Barak. Moreover, they kept reporting to me his good deeds, and then telling him what I said. And Tobiah sent letters to intimidate me. What's going on here? Well, first, let me remind you of something. The opposition that is mustered against you and your spiritual progress, your enemy never has only one string on his banjo. Never. He has multiple ways, multiple tactics at which he will go at you. We think that if we make one choice, we think that if we make one commitment and one decision, that should be good. That we'll just make that one decision and it will send the enemy fleeing, scurrying. No, not all struggles and temptation go packing with one walk down an aisle, with one prayer prayed, with one decision made at an event or rally or church service. The enemy comes quickly at us from another direction. And as I said, the seeds of compromise were previously sown. One of Nehemiah's enemies, Tobiah, had already infiltrated the inner workings of Jerusalem years before by marrying into a prominent Jewish family. You can turn here, I'll put it up on the screen. Chapter 7, verse 10 gives us an insight. For many in Judah, this is chapter 6, verse 10. For many in Judah were under oath to him, Tobiah, since he was son-in-law to Shechaniah, son of Ara, and his son Jehoiachin, which means favored by Jehovah, had married the daughter of Meshullam, son of Berechiah. One of Nehemiah's enemies had married into this family, and then when he married into that family, he had a son, and he named him Jehoiachin, which means favored by Jehovah. And so what people are doing is they're saying, listen, you're saying all this terrible stuff about Tobiah. He's not a bad guy. In fact, he is Shechaniah's son-in-law. And when he had a kid, he named his kid favored by Jehovah. It's like somebody saying, hey, I want to introduce you to my fiance, Charlie Manson. And he's really, he can't be a bad guy because he has a son and he named his son Christian. It proves nothing. You see, they had made their enemy their in-law. Now, we know that it's usually the other way around, right? But they took this person who was literally their enemy and allowed their daughter to marry Tobiah, and now there are all sorts of complications. Now there are all sorts of connections to deal with. Now sure, Tobiah didn't want Jerusalem rebuilt, and sure, he had threatened and intimidated and even tried to kill Nehemiah, but he's not such a bad guy. So what Nehemiah finds is Tobiah's friends and relatives come to him and plead his case. They kept reporting to me, it says, his good deeds. The question is, why did these families compromise in the first place? Why did they come from an exile where they were conquered and dragged away after their city was destroyed by these other countries? In the first place, because they had dishonored their God. One of the ways that they had dishonored God was by intermarrying with these other nations. God said, don't do that. Don't give your sons and daughters in marriage to their sons and daughters. Don't do it. And now they come back, and the first thing they do in order to appease the enemies that are living around Jerusalem is they say, you want to marry my daughter? Okay, that's cool. You want to have children together so that our children are part Jew and part Arab? That's fine. The first thing that probably motivated them was people. Fear that they needed to get along with the powerful people around them. They thought, if we're related, they will be less likely to kill us. Because now we will not only have sons and daughters married to each other, but we will have kids and grandkids in common. And the second was the things. Business deals. Loans. Verse 18 says, many in Judah were under oath to him. There was money to be made. There were contracts to be fulfilled. And they needed to protect their investments. Do you think God knows what he's talking about when he warns us of the dangers of getting into situations where we will be compromised by our relationships with people that don't understand God, that don't care about God, that don't think his priorities should matter one bit? People do it all the time. We get into relationships, not just dating relationships, not just marriages, but business relationships and so forth with people who do not honor God. That's why God said, 2 Corinthians chapter 6, don't team up with those who are unbelievers. How can righteousness be a partner with wickedness? How can light live with darkness? But here's the realization that Nehemiah must have had at this point. Tobiah has had inside information all the time. People that told him exactly what Nehemiah was doing and exactly what Nehemiah was saying because they were related to him. And people who were doing the exact same thing on Tobiah's behalf because they owed him. They were business partners. They owed him money. He had loaned them something. They had made an oath to him. Wow. Who can be trusted? Nehemiah finds that there are certain people who have made a deal with the devil, if you will. They have a pact and a covenant with an unrighteous person, and Nehemiah needs to secure this city. The point here is not be careful about what you say and do around folks because you never know who their connection might be. Not that that's an invalid point. I learned that when I lived up in Fremont for a number of years. You don't say anything about anyone anywhere because their cousin is always sitting behind you in the booth right back there. Crazy town, I'm telling you. But that, not that that's a bad lesson, but that's not the point here. The point is you always have to be thinking defensively. You always have to be thinking about protecting the territory that God has given you, protecting the gains that have been made, because the next commitment will fall on top of previous commitments kept, made and kept. And so, what's Nehemiah going to do? The priorities remain simple. The priorities are the ones that he has already put into place. You have to remain wise, and you have to remain vigilant. Chapter 7. After the wall had been rebuilt, and I had set the doors in place, the gatekeepers and the singers and the Levites were appointed, I put in charge of Jerusalem my brother Hanani, along with Hananiah, the commander of the citadel, because he was a man of integrity and feared God more than most men do. I said to them, the gates of Jerusalem are not to be opened until the sun is hot. While the gatekeepers are still on duty, have them shut the doors and bar them. Also appoint residents of Jerusalem as guards, some at their posts and some near their own houses. Here's what happens in this transition from being builders to being watchmen. The workers have to become watchmen. The workers have to become watchmen. There was a time during the rebuilding process that the workers were also the warriors. They had building materials in one hand and a sword or a spear in the other hand. Remember that chapter? That's how they had to work because there was that threat against them that any moment we're going to rush into the city and we're going to attack and overwhelm you and kill you. So they worked and they were warriors at the same time. And just because the wall is up doesn't mean that you can let your guard down. It's interesting, these two men that are given charge over the city, Hananiah and Hananiah, their qualifications say nothing about their military resume, says nothing about their size, says nothing about their strength. Their qualifications, men of integrity who feared God more than most. But everyone had a responsibility to help protect the city. And I love what Nehemiah does. He purposely puts people in guard stations near their own homes and families, knowing that they will be more alert and will fight harder to protect their own loved ones and their own property than they would anything else. Look at the wisdom and the balance that he strikes here. Just a couple of things that would be easy to read past. He says, access to the city must be restricted. We've got these walls and now we've got these gates. And we do not want to make this a prison where the city is closed all the time. But there must be guidelines and controls. So open the gates to allow business. Sun goes up. It's hot. It's the heat of the day. It's high noon, the shadows are minimal. Open them. Let the people in and out, let them do business, but watch everyone who comes in and goes out. But then before it gets too late, close the gates. Close the gates because you must know when to seal things off. You must know when to close the gates to guard the city. Some people and some things, listen, must be kept out. You're not strong if you set no limits. You're reckless. You're not strong. You're foolhardy if you set no limits. Essential to your spiritual well-being is a willingness to guard your life. And so here's what I'd like to do. I'd like to ask you to picture your life as a city. Picture your life as a city. This is not us as a church. This is you as an individual, as a mom, as a dad, as a grandparent, as a young person, as a child. Your life is like a city. Question number one, what's its foundation? What foundation are you building your life on? Matthew chapter 7, verse 24, Jesus said, "Anyone who listens to my teaching and follows it is wise, like a person who builds a house on solid rock." Jesus said, "You hear my words and you put them into practice. You build your foundation on my truth." That's a life that can last. Here's the next question. Oh, each wise choice and decision is a part of the wall. So what's your foundation, and then what are you building on that foundation, I guess would be the way to put that in question form. Every wise choice and decision that you make is a part of the wall. Paul put it this way in 1 Corinthians chapter 3. "For no one can lay any foundation other than the one we already have, Jesus Christ. Hearing his words, putting them into practice, a relationship with him." Then he takes it to the next level. Then you build something on that foundation. "Anyone who builds on that foundation may use a variety of materials. Gold, silver, jewels, line of demarcation, wood, hay, or straw." The difference between the first three building materials is not simply their value. It's their ability to endure. The last three can rot, can burn easily. But on Judgment Day, fire will reveal what kind of work each builder has done. The fire will show if the person's work has any value. So what Paul is saying is this. So you've got this foundation. The foundation must be Jesus Christ. That's the only one that matters. And then you get to choose. What am I going to build on that? Am I going to build the important things, the precious things, the things that will last? Or am I just going to throw junk on top of that foundation and not worry about the quality and not worry about the durability of it? What are you building your walls with? Next, you need to view each compromise as a terrorist. We think sometimes that compromise, in light of what God says is best for us or the commitments that we've made to him, is no huge deal. Compromise is a huge deal. Every compromise is a terrorist. 2 Corinthians, Paul again, chapter 6. "Who would think of setting up pagan idols in God's holy temple? But that is exactly what we are, his temple. Each of us a temple in whom God lives. God himself put it this way, 'I'll live in them, move into them. I'll be their God and they'll be my people.' So leave the corruption and compromise. Leave it for good," God says. Every time we compromise, we take something of value and we make it something of little value. It's not appropriate for God's people. And then every spiritual discipline and relationship is a watchman providing defense. Time alone with God, time spent reading his word, time spent in prayer, time spent in meaningful fellowship with other Christians, challenging them and being challenged in return. All of those things are the watchmen that God has given you to put in place in your life to defend you, protect you spiritually. This morning I'm calling you to build a wall. I'm urging you to set the gates and to put watchmen in place. I'm warning you that the enemy's tactics demand that you be wise and vigilant. September 11th, 2001, our nation was attacked. And what we realized, among other things, many other things on that day, was that our enemy could use the freedoms that we enjoyed against us. And I understand that there is a serious risk in all of our freedoms that we've enjoyed being surrendered so that we can say now we're free because we have no freedoms. But they learned how to exploit things that we used to take for granted against us. For example, you used to go to an airport, You could walk up to any gate. Your loved one was flying in. You'd walk up to that gate. You'd wait for them. Now you go to the airport. They keep you in some distant holding area, and those people have to come all the way off the plane and all the way down the ramps. You used to be able to check your baggage and walk onto a plane with very, very little security scrutiny. Not anymore. Why? Because the people that took over those planes took advantage of all the lax security and they turned it against us. And it's the same way with your spiritual enemy. He will use everything that you could see and enjoy as a freedom, and he will potentially use that against you and turn it against you to make it a threat to your soul. Be wise. Be vigilant. Know that you have the right foundation. Know what you're building the walls with, and set those spiritual discipline watchmen in place. Here's the question as we close this morning. It's gone. What is my threat level? Threat is the last blank. How serious am I taking the threat against me? And right now, as I view my life, do I see myself in a place of strength and security? Do I have the right people and the right things in place in my life? Or do I feel like, man, the foundation's a little shifty and a little shaky right now? What is the threat level? And get some help. Come to a Christian friend. Ask them to help you assess the spiritual threat level in your own life. God, help us. Defend us. The truth is, we probably, on an average day, don't even realize how vulnerable we are. How much our enemy, who loves to steal and kill and destroy, wants to have at us, wants to tear us down, wants to destroy our reputation, our integrity. He wants to make us look foolish so that you look bad. God, we want our lives to honor you. Help us to take the steps that you prescribe to build the wall and to set the watchman in place to protect ourselves and our families spiritually. God, give us a passionate love for your word, your truth, and for communion with you. And guard us, we pray, in Jesus' name. Amen. You're dismissed.